The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll be reading from the March 2023 issue of Smithsonian. We'll begin with an article titled Message Received by Jenny Rothenberg Gritz. Glory goes to the African-American women who achieved a vital mission in World War II, getting mail to the troops. When Romae Johnson Davis was in her 20s, she decided to do something millions of young men across the country were doing, enlist in World War II. All five of her brothers had already joined up. They were being pulled away one by one, and I had no playmates, Davis recalls. Most young women were staying in the United States and helping out on the home front. Even the iconic Rosie the Riveter was urging women to work in factories, not ship out overseas. But Davis's parents supported their only daughter's decision. My father was skeptical sometimes about my going off, but Mama said, "Child, see the world while you can." That's how Davis found herself on the Ile de France in February 1945, en route to Glasgow, Scotland. Among the passengers on board were more than 800 recruits from her unit, women mostly in their late teens and 20s, and in the segregated army of the era, all of them black. They would be doing something crucial to the war effort, clearing a massive backlog of undelivered mail. For 2 years or longer, soldiers had been waiting for letters and packages that still hadn't arrived. Morale was flagging, and no one had been able to process the millions of individual pieces of mail piled up in European warehouses from floor to ceiling. During their ocean crossing, the ship suddenly lurched. Barrels rolled and young women screamed. Later, the group would learn that their captain had swerved to dodge an attack by a German U-boat. But at the height of the pandemonium, with heavy furniture sliding across the floor, all Davis knew was that there was no use panicking. She scolded her crying companions. "You can't get off the ship," she said. "You have to train yourself not to be so frightened that you can't enjoy." At 103 years old, Davis is the oldest surviving member of the 6,888th Central Postal Directory Battalion, the first battalion of African American women ever to serve in the U.S. military overseas. She can tell stories of working long shifts in a rat-infested warehouses in England and France, of chauffeuring military personnel around Europe during the deadliest conflict in human history. When she looks back at the U-boat incident, her voice brims with amusement and pride. "I asked the girls," I said, "now what's the point of being afraid right now? You can't do one earthly thing but pray," she says with a chuckle. "I guess I was the brave one." African American men have been serving in the U.S. military since the American Revolution. During the Civil War, about 10% of Union soldiers were black. By World War I, black men were mostly limited to menial labor. There were exceptions. The 369th Infantry Regiment, a black unit known as the Harlem Hellfighters, started out unloading cargo on the docks, but when the French needed reinforcements in the trenches, the Hellfighters battled alongside them with a valor that earned them the prestigious Croix de Guerre. Meanwhile, some 1,800 black women were certified as nurses by the American Red Cross, but only 18 of them were allowed to actually serve, and even then, only at training camps in the U.S. In 1941, U.S. Representative Edith Norse Rogers of Massachusetts introduced a bill that would give women a larger role in the armed forces. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed a version of the bill into law, establishing the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, WAAC, for the purpose of making available to the national defense the knowledge, skill, and special training of women of the nation. The pioneering black educator, Mary McLeod Bethune, working closely alongside her friend, First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, argued for a more prominent role for black women in the military. "We must not fail America," Bethune urged her fellow African Americans. "And as Americans, we must not let America fail us." In 1943, the WAAC dropped the word auxiliary and allowed women to become members of the regular army. Fanny Griffin McClendon, now 102, remembers enlisting in the army in New York City. "I was just graduating from high school at the time," she says, "and I decided to go down and take the exam and see if they accept me," which they did. She went out to celebrate afterwards with five other newly minted recruits who were also black. She wasn't used to drinking, and she returned to her apartment tipsy. Her mother was dismayed to learn that she joined the army, asking her daughter, "This is why you want to go into the service, so you can drink?" McClendon's training at Fort Des Moines in Iowa was anything but a party. The recruits were impeccably dressed and ready each morning at 6:15. Reveille exercises were at 6:30, and after breakfast, the group spent all day marching formally between various classes and training sessions. Bed checks were at 11. On Saturdays, inspecting officers scrutinized every inch of their rooms and bathrooms and subjected them to intense questioning. All the while, the black women were kept separate from their white counterparts. Altogether, about 6,500 black women enlisted in the Women's Army Corps during World War II. Charity Edna Adams, a young woman from South Carolina, was recommended by a dean at Wilberforce University, where she graduated with a triple major in math, physics, and Latin, and a minor in history. In her captivating 1989 memoir, One Woman's Army, Charity Adams Early, as she was then named, described her first trip home from Fort Des Moines. A steward on the train tried to bar her from the dining car, declaring, "All persons in uniform first." Before she could object, a blonde man with a southern accent called out, "Well, what in the hell do you think that is that she has on?" Her defender, a second lieutenant, went on, "What in the world are we fighting this damned war for? She's giving her service to and can eat anywhere I can. And by Jesus, I'm going to eat with her in this diner." The steward finally let Adams through, and the blonde soldier did sit at her table. As black women rose through the ranks, civilians and military personnel continued to challenge their credentials. When Adams was promoted to major, a white colonel called her to his office and said bluntly, "Don't let being an officer go to your head. You are still colored, and I want you to remember that. You people have to stay in your place. Why, your folks might have been slaves to my people right in South Carolina." The tirade went on for 3/4 of an hour, she wrote in her memoir, adding, "I was proud of the fact that I maintained the position of attention for the whole time." In mid-December 1944, shortly after Adams's 26th birthday, a colonel asked whether she'd like to go overseas. She wondered if his question was rhetorical, since no group of African-American WACs had ever been sent to Europe. But Adams had been chosen to lead the first. A daunting task awaited the members of the 6,888th Central Postal Directory Battalion. All U.S. service members stationed in Europe had individual file cards noting where they were at any given time. But the troops had been moving quickly, and the mail had fallen far behind. It didn't help that so many service members had the same name. For instance, there were 7,500 Robert Smiths, many listed under variations like Bob, Rob, and Bobby. After their harrowing voyage to Glasgow, the recruits traveled to Birmingham, England, where they moved into the King Edward School building. Their accommodations were primitive, with showers outside in the courtyard and the freezing February air. Their work environment was worse. One of the battalion's first tasks was to clear 6 airplane hangars filled to the brim with mail, including huge piles of Christmas parcels that arrived during the recent Battle of the Bulge. Rats and other vermin were feasting on the baked goods. Windows were blacked out to deter air raids. The unit worked round the clock 7 days a week in 3 8-hour shifts that each processed an average of more than 65,000 pieces of mail. Some packages had been damaged beyond repair, so a special unit had to reassemble their scattered contents by matching up dates and packing materials. The 6888, as they were called, also had the task of censoring letters, making sure no sensitive information would compromise the war effort. The job seemed juicy at first, but many of the letters were tediously long-winded. In film footage from the era, the women of the 6888 looked cheerful and energetic as they sort letters and packages into bins and cubes. "We as black women were used to being together as family," explained one of the women in the 2019 documentary, The 6888, No Mail, Low Morale. "We were trained and brought up like that. We respected each other. When trouble came with us, we were all together. That's why I think we got that mail down." The women had to do everything for themselves. They fixed their own trucks and they fixed one another's hair. White WACs in Europe could go to local beauty parlors, wherever they happened to be stationed. But black women needed special equipment and expertise that would have been available in Birmingham, Alabama, but not in Birmingham, England. The group's officers succeeded in getting all the straightening combs, Marcel irons, and other staples they needed, and the unit built its own beauty salon. African-American nurses stationed around the area began showing up on their days off to get their hair done properly. On March 20th, a white male general paid a visit. He wanted to see every member of the unit, but Adams told him that only a third of the women were available to appear in formation. The others were working, sleeping, showering, eating, or otherwise occupied. Unsatisfied, the general told Adams he would send a white first lieutenant to show the major how to run her battalion. "Over my dead body, sir," she replied. The outraged general left, promising Adams she would hear from him again. By midnight, she learned that he was preparing to draw up court-martial charges against her. The officers of the 6888 rushed to draw up their own court-martial charges against the general, accusing him of violating an order that prohibited racially charged language. The goal of that order was to keep America's allies from worrying about the lack of harmony among U.S. troops. The general ultimately dropped his charges, and the 6888 dropped theirs. By May 1945, the women had achieved in 3 months what no one before them had managed to do in 2 years. They cleared the backlog in England. From there, they were transferred to Rouen, France, to tackle more mail issues. The women of the 6888 found themselves in a jubilant country, fresh from the extended VE Day celebrations. Their pride at being part of military history intensified as they slept in barracks where Napoleon's troops were said to have stayed, and marched to the site where Joan of Arc had been burned at the stake. On the continent, the group had a more interesting social life than they had in Birmingham. The athletes in the 6888 formed sports teams and competed with other WAC units. When word got out that a battalion of African American women were stationed in Rouen, black male soldiers began flocking to their gates, along with some white ones. The men invited them out on weekends for dinner, dancing, and other excursions. One of those outings led to McClendon's darkest memory of the 6888. Three women from the battalion, Mary H. Bankston, Mary Jewel Barlow, and Dolores Mercedes Brown, were killed in a Jeep accident while riding with male soldiers. "I had to identify two of the girls because they didn't have their dog tags on," McClendon recalls. The battalion's leaders made all the funeral arrangements, tasking German prisoners with building wooden caskets. The young women were laid to rest at the Normandy American Cemetery, three of only four women to be buried there alongside more than 9,000 men. The fourth, Elizabeth Ann Richardson, was a Red Cross volunteer killed in a Piper Cub plane crash near New Rouen in July 1945. Before the 6888 left Europe, Adams received a visit from the general who'd berated her in Birmingham. "It's not easy to say what I've come to say," he told her, according to her memoir. "The only Negroes I have ever known personally were those who were in servant capacity or my subordinates in the army. It's been a long time since anyone challenged me, black or white, but you took me on. You outsmarted me, and I'm proud that I know you." The 6888 finished their work in early 1946, clearing out the last backlogs of mail in Paris. A booklet called the WAC, published in late 1945, declared that the 6888 had broken all existing records for mail delivery. Their leader, Charity Adams, was promoted to lieutenant colonel. After the WAC directors, it was the highest possible rank for a woman in the U.S. Armed Forces at the time. The European theater of war could be grueling, but for the women of the 6888, it was also liberating. Paris and London were cosmopolitan and eye-opening. The restaurants and dance halls weren't segregated in Europe, and the women were invited to eat as honored guests at the homes of local families. They returned to the U.S. with broad new perspectives, but America wasn't quite ready to catch up. During the war, black newspapers and labor organizations launched what was known as the Double V campaign, a push for civil rights victories at home along with victories against fascism abroad. Langston Hughes captured the spirit in his poem, Beaumont to Detroit, 1943. "I ask you this question because I want to know how long I got to fight both Hitler and Jim Crow." But if returning black soldiers expected the same reception as white service members, they were tragically disappointed. In the South especially, they were often met with derision, even deadly violence. Black women faced another set of obstacles. The war had given women of all races a chance to serve in empowering new roles. But once the war was over, women were removed from the workforce so returning male soldiers could take over their jobs. In the military, it would be decades until women could serve in the same units as men. There was no parade for the 6888, no honor or glory. As Corporal Lena Derricott Bell King later put it, "We never heard anything more about it. All of that was behind us." Ramey Johnson Davis had hoped to become a doctor, but only a few elite universities for African Americans offered medical degrees, making those spots highly competitive. Her military record didn't make any difference. At the time, Davis recalls wryly, black people weren't joyously invited to do anything. Instead of medicine, Davis studied fashion design and made clothing for a living. She also traveled widely, including two trips to Africa. "I got lost two or three times traveling while I was in a foreign country, on the street by myself," she says. "Not safe, not a wise thing to do, but I couldn't resist it." When she was in her 70s, Davis joined a friend's young son at Taekwondo classes and went on to earn a black belt. Her adventures in the 6888 shaped the course of her life, showing her from an early age, as she now puts it, the world is big and wide. Cherie Robertson, the daughter of 6888 veteran Anna Mae Robertson, says her parents, both World War II veterans who migrated from the South to Milwaukee, continued to serve their country in a civilian way. She and her seven siblings used to join their parents at fair housing marches led by Father James Groppi, a local Catholic priest who spearheaded much of Milwaukee's civil rights activism. Anna Mae used to sing to her children the gospel song and civil rights anthem, "This Little Light of Mine." "When people ask me about my mother," Cherie says, "I say she's a bright light because she's done good in her life and her light shines brightly." McClendon was one of the few members of the 6888 who went on to have a career in the military. Shortly after the end of World War II, she enlisted in the Air Force. She was promoted to major and married another major, and both of them served until they retired. But she expected to end her life without any special recognition for her service in World War II. So she was astonished in her 90s when she learned that she and the other members of the 6888 were finally going to be honored as heroes. Colonel Edna Cummings was reading online one day in 2015 when she stumbled upon a story about another African-American colonel named Edna, Charity Edna Adams. It caught my attention, especially some of the challenges she had gaining respect, being a trailblazer and a pioneer, says Cummings. A retired Army officer now in her 60s, who has held leadership positions at the Department of Defense and the FBI. There were so many similarities between her story and mine. Cummings helped lead an effort for a monument to the 6888 at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Back in the 1990s, General Colin Powell had championed a memorial there for the Buffalo Soldiers, the first African-American regiments formed after the Civil War. Commander Carlton G. Philpott, an African-American Navy historian who led the fundraising for that project, was enthusiastic about adding a statue to honor the 1st Battalion of African-American women. On a chilly November day in 2018, five members of the 6888 attended the unveiling ceremony in wheelchairs, their laps covered with blankets. My dad is a World War II veteran, said Jerry Moran, the senior U.S. Senator from Kansas, addressing the women. I never thought about it on a personal level until I was with you today, what role you and others played in my family's life to make sure my mom and dad communicated with each other for the long period of World War II. So from my family, a personal thank you to you for keeping two people who loved each other together. You did them a great service. When we unveil this memorial, when we unveil this monument, what we're really saying is this. Thank you for your service. We respect you and we love you. God bless you. That was just the beginning. James Theories, the historian who directed the 6888 documentary, suggested to Cummings that the women should be awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. The directors had produced an early documentary about the Hello Girls, a group of several dozen white American recruits who ran the telephone lines in France during World War I, and he'd been involved in legislation to honor them with the medal, an effort that is still in progress. He basically gave me a template, Cummings says. I worked in the Pentagon. It's just like staff work. You develop a draft and you just start making calls. Moran was happy to sponsor the legislation. He was joined by Gwen Moore, a U.S. representative from Wisconsin who knew Anna Mae Robertson's daughter, Sheree. Was a promising start, especially since Moran was a Republican and Moore was a Democrat. But a Congressional Gold Medal needs approval from at least two-thirds of Congress. Historically, the bar has been extremely high. George Washington was the first to receive the medal in 1776 before he became president. Other notable recipients include aviation pioneers Orville and Wilbur Wright, inventor Thomas Edison, polio vaccine developer Jonas Salk, animator Walt Disney, and poet Robert Frost. The singer Marian Anderson was the first African-American to receive the honor in 1977. Word went out among veterans, churches, and other networks of people who might be able to help persuade politicians. African-American newspaper archives from the World War II era proved to be a huge asset. They had stories about individual members of the battalion, and Cummings was able to get a list of the women's hometowns. That made it easier for constituents to call their representatives and mention 6888 veterans who came from their own districts. In the end, the bill passed unanimously in both the Senate and the House of Representatives. President Joe Biden signed it into law on March 14, 2022. The medal, now in process of being minted, will have a unique design which duplicates available for honorees and their families. In the words of the bill, the medal will recognize the contributions made by these women to increase the morale of all United States personnel stationed in the European Theater of Operations during World War II. Nearly 80 years later, the women had once again unified the country and boosted morale. As Cummings puts it, I like to think the 6888 brought Congress together. Since then, the fame of the 6888 has been growing. In August 2022, a committee made up of mostly retired military officers recommended that Fort Lee, a Virginia Army base, be renamed after two African-American officers, Arthur Gregg and Charity Adams. This summer, Stephen Ambrose Historical Tours, the leading outfit for World War II tourism, will offer its first 6888 Legacy Tour, which stops at every location where the battalion served. A Broadway musical about the 6th AAA is in the works. So is a Netflix film written and directed by Tyler Perry and starring Kerry Washington and Oprah Winfrey. The sudden barrage of attention is gratifying for the centenarian veterans, but it also can be a bit tiring. Romee Davis says the rise of celebrity status, while so exciting and so unreal, would have been a lot easier to handle earlier in life. It's exciting when you're young and vital and kicking up your heels and all that, she says. Still, that wasn't the reason these women joined the Army. I would have climbed up a mountain to get on that list to serve overseas, declared 6888 veteran Gladys Carter. We were going to do our duty despite all the bad things that happened. America was our home. Anna Mae Robertson put it even more straightforwardly. I just decided that I wanted to be in the Army. I guess I felt as though I wanted to do something. Her daughter, Cherie, who played a major role in the Congressional Gold Medal effort, appreciates that her mother is one of the very few members of the battalion who lived to enjoy any glory. She makes sure to add, I didn't need anyone to give my mother a Congressional Gold Medal to recognize her for her military service to validate who she is. Yet the award is validating for Americans from all walks of life, especially other African Americans whose own achievements have been hard won. Those women did an awful lot to inspire people and were not acknowledged for it, says John Thompson Jr., famed coach of the Georgia Hoyas basketball team, Georgetown Hoyas basketball team in the 6888 documentary. Actor Blair Underwood, the executive producer of the forthcoming musical, told Broadway.com why he was moved to be part of the project. The women of the 6888 are true American patriots who are long overdue to have their story told. The medal holds special meaning for the African Americans who make up a third of all women in the U.S. Armed Forces today. Cummings was the first black woman ROTC graduate at her university. Throughout her long career, she's been honored in the Army Women's Foundation Hall of Fame and received a certificate of special congressional recognition. But she still recalls lower-ranking men at the Pentagon who failed to salute her until she reprimanded them. You don't salute officers? There's a reason she worked so tirelessly to get recognition for the 6888. They're the role model she and so many others wish they'd always have. As far as Congress is concerned, the 6888 were simply great Americans who crossed oceans and cultural barriers to serve their country brilliantly. They kept troops connected with their loved ones back home and made America a more perfect union. When the Congressional Gold Medal is minted, it will hang in the Smithsonian for everyone to see. A mirror for our better selves and a beacon for all the brave girls still to come. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.